Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Happy Wednesday morning to you. It is the first day of May. Yeah. Ray Parker Jr. I'm going to play a little Ghostbusters for you, but I didn't. I'm Andy Griffin. Thanks for tuning in to the program. I believe we're going to have Dr. Blodgett here shortly. He is not here yet, but given the state of traffic in our beautiful hometown, it does not surprise me that he would be caught in traffic. So there's this website out there. It's called daysoftheyear.com. I don't know if you've like figured this out. I certainly have, as I've been in this morning show business 5 years now, is actually longer because I did a sports one. But every day is National Day of whatever. Today is, National Skilled Trades Day. Today is National World Carnivorous Plant Day. National Chocolate Parfait Day. There's something I could really put my weight behind, or maybe in front of, or whatever. And today is National Celiac Awareness Month. It's the start of National Celiac Awareness Month, and Dr. Blodgett is with us now, and we'll get him to pull up a microphone and get him on the air here. It's good to see him, Dr. Blodgett, of course, former chief resident doctor at Johns Hopkins University and our health official, the manager, the CEO, the boss man of the health department here in five counties of southern Utah. Welcome.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about celiacs a little bit. This is a disease I would say 10 years ago, never heard of it.
Yeah.
Now I know, maybe five or six people who have celiacs.
Yeah, it's fortunately still pretty rare, but not rare enough.
You will
run into people that, have it. So a true gluten allergy, or what it does is it causes you to strip out all the cilia from your intestinal tract so that you
end up
not being able to absorb minerals and food and everything very well. So that's different than wheat intolerance
you always hear about dairy intolerance.
Don't want to eat gluten, but they're not true celiac. Don't have celiac disease. So that's there's that little bit of a discrepancy that I think causes confusion for a lot of people. So
so my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, and her daughter both have celiacs, and you hear about dairy intolerance. Well, if I take a little, they have some kind of pill you take, and you can handle a little bit of dairy. And so we kind of, at first, I remember them coming over. I'm like, well, you can have a little bit of, bread or whatever, right? You can have a little bit of gluten. They're like, no, that's the thing. It's not that I don't want gluten. It's not that I might get a little sick with gluten. It's that gluten could quite literally shorten my life.
Yeah, it's very, very dramatic. So,
celiac disease,
diarrhea, and that stripping away of the cilia is it leads to weight loss and difficulties with just trying to manage life. So, it takes sometimes years for people to figure out what they have going on. Know they don't feel well, and once they get it figured out and they get on that very strict diet, it really helps.
One thing I did notice that with my niece, she used to come over all the time because she was going to school down here in southern Utah. But we got pretty good at figuring out some decent recipes that didn't have gluten in them. And there are some. I mean, it took a little trial and error, right? I mean, imagine not putting flour in your cookies, stuff like that.
I just think of how much of what we eat is wheat based. Pasta.
Bread, any sandwiches. Kind of bread, cookies, pastries, any of that. So anyway, today is the start of Celiac Awareness Month. If you know someone with celiacs, they're not faking it. They're not trying to make, you know, ruin your dinner party or whatever. They literally can't do wheat. It just doesn't work for them. So
it's an interesting exercise to have one to have somebody come for dinner, and then you you realize, wow, well,
yeah, how much on this table has wheat in it? Yeah, even things like I found out that there are certain, you know, I like to barbecue, Dr. Blodgett. I like to smoke meat. Sometimes the rubs you put on your meat, some of that will have gluten in it, and you have to just kind of be aware. You know, yeah. If someone's coming for that has that, you can't do it. It makes them sick.
You get you get very good at reading labels for sure.
Yeah. That's right. Need reader's glasses at my age, though, to read all those little labels. Again, it's the Andy Griffin Show. Dr. David Blodgett is here. I know you guys through April is over, but you guys had the I would get the letters in there, the pre-diabetes test.
A1C.
A1C. I want to say 1A and AC, yeah. And it's A1C.
Yes. Yeah. We had all month long, they were free for those that screened out to be pre-diabetic, or could be, have a high likelihood of being pre-diabetic. We're trying to help, you know, the data is that probably 25% of the population is pre-diabetic.
Wow.
And, you can stop the progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes with fairly simple interventions, and, you know, not having diabetes is a very good thing.
Yeah.
Having diabetes is not a good thing. And so we were hoping to increase awareness of that. But it's something that people can continue to do. We have a screening test on our website. You can go on and it'll ask some basic questions. And then a follow-up to that could be an A1C test if you want to get that. We offer them for, I think it's $35.
Pretty cheap. So even though they're not free anymore, it's still, you know, if you can prevent diabetes by getting this test.
Yeah, and we'll see if we can scrape together some more money and do another one in the fall, something like that. But
I had the opportunity a couple days ago to write a story about, coming up with the health department is Stop the Bleed, May 23rd, free class. And you can go and, you know, the gist of the article I wrote and kind of the gist of Stop the Bleed is, if an accident happens in your home, and the sword I used was a man who he was cutting, trimming branches on his on his tree out in his own yard. Well, he hit something hard or something slipped, and he cut his leg with the instrument. I think it was a chainsaw or maybe one of those electric trimmers, whatever, and cut his leg and started bleeding. And his wife realized at that moment. First responders, that may be a little bit of a misnomer. We refer to emergency and paramedics as first responders. They're actually the second responders. The first responder is you.
It's whoever's around there, yeah.
So Stop the Bleed is basically a plan, a class to help you have the ammunition, the tools to, treat something on a very short-term basis, but something that will get you to those medical professionals. Before your patient expires or whatever. So let's talk a little bit. First of all, Dr. Blodgett, what are the basic things that a mom or dad or grandma or grandpa should know, knowing that an emergency could happen at any time? What are some of the basic things that we need to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just all about basic first aid. We all learned when we were kids, right? And I'm not sure we do that very well anymore.
Well, you were a Boy Scout and then maybe didn't think about it again. I haven't been a Boy Scout for 40 years now, yeah. 45 years. So
even that, though, was a lot better training than I think we see now. And
true.
So direct pressure often is your first line of defense. And, keeping the wound clean if you can, those kinds of things, just depending on the severity of things. But we used to do a lot of training around tourniquets and stuff like that. And I think mostly it's about direct pressure.
Yeah. Direct pressure is big. And I'm glad you brought up tourniquets because I was actually going to ask about that. I remember learning very young, you don't want to do a tourniquet because they might lose a limb because you're basically cutting off circulation to that limb. And then somewhere along the way, maybe in my 20s, somebody said, yeah, but better that someone would lose a limb than to lose their life. If there's no other way to stop the bleeding, that might be your only alternative.
Yeah, so most of the time we're talking about just being able to stop the bleeding enough to get them to the hospital, you know. And so in those situations, tourniquets probably aren't necessary. But if you're out in the bush somewhere, you're miles from anywhere, it might be the difference between life and death. So.
And looking at your website, again, the Stop the Bleed class is May 23rd. The health department, Dr. Blodgett, is asking that you do register for it, but it'll take place at 10 o'clock in the morning, 10 to 11:15 in Cedar City, and then 1:30 in St. George, 1:30 at your health department there in the conference room at 1:30 for a Stop the Bleed class.
Yeah.
You think about it, in the course of your lifetime, you've been around accidents before. I remember, gosh, I was 19, 18, something like that, and my buddy cut the tip of his thumb off in a table saw. And honestly, the foreman knew what to do, and, you know, we were in a wood shop, professional wood shop, but most of the rest of us were like, what do we do now? You know, there's blood dripping everywhere. We didn't know what to do, so... Beyond direct pressure, what are some other things? I know CPR. How important is it that we know CPR as well?
It's become less important over time. Okay. And so now they don't really recommend the breathing portion. It's just the chest compression.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Now, why is that?
I think they just found it didn't help in the overall. Yeah, when you think about what it takes to stop somebody's heart from beating, it's a big deal, and once the heart stops, it's very difficult to recover that. And so, you know, maybe if it's an electrical stimulation or something, you know, you get shocked or something like that, maybe that can do it. Maybe a drowning, but for most situations, once the heart is diseased enough or damaged enough to stop beating, the rates of recovery from that, even if they're in the ICU and you have all that equipment around, are small.
Pretty low.
And so, so I think that had something to do with it. I think they found if you can keep the heart beating, it still is moving what oxygen is there around, and probably isn't doing a ton to do the breathing part. But, you know, it's great to have skills to know how to do that, how to help somebody that's choking, how to help somebody that's bleeding, all of those kind of basic skills. The number one skill I learned in medicine was don't panic. If you panic, then nothing goes right? But just try and be as clear-headed as you can.
And that may be the toughest one to deal with. Right. You might have all this knowledge. You might be, mentally, emotionally prepared, and then it happens.
Right.
And panic sets in, especially if it's... I remember I had a lady on, she worked in the emergency room. She sees all kinds of what you see in an emergency room, all kinds of stuff. But when her own kid gashes his head open, she was like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Well, she did know what to do, but she didn't know how to make her brain tell her body to do it.
Once you let that adrenaline start coursing and you start the fear cycle, it's just very difficult to think clearly and get done. So, you know, a little bit of self-care. In the moment where you say, you know what, I need to be as present as I can be here to kind of help things.
We see so many times in emergencies, people just panic. And like you said, and then they, you know, things they could probably do, they don't do. Are there any weapons or tools to help us get through the panic part of it? Anything we can do?
So, they call it code blue, they call it in medicine, where you're going into somebody's heart's actually stopped beating and you're trying to help them. And I used to always think in my mind, you know, this is something that I've thought about. This is something that, you know, I've done the basics myself to learn how to do this. And so, I have to draw on that. I have to remember that, you know, there's things that can be done, and I'll do the best that I can. But You know, as soon as I lose my composure, then everybody else in the room loses their composure. And it just doesn't help. And so, deep breathing, all those kind of relaxation things that you think about, but just being present in the moment enough to say, what is it that I need to be doing? What are the actions I can be taking that will help this situation, as opposed to taking a step back and allowing the moment to overcome your emotions?
So when you're a trained professional, a doctor in particular, in an emergency room setting or some kind of emergency setting, how hard is it to, when it's someone that you love, it's a family member, it's a child of yours, or a brother, or a father, or a mother, how hard is it to separate yourself? Because you still have your job to do. You still have the training that you spent your whole life training on.
Yeah.
And yet, you know this person, you know, very, very closely. Is it hard to remove yourself from that and just do the job?
You know, it is. They have a saying in medicine, at least back when I was training, they said the person that treats themselves as a doctor has a fool for a doctor.
Kind of like the lawyer thing. He represents himself as a fool for a client. Yeah. Same kind of thing.
So, I really think, it's clearly an emergency situation. You need to do the best you can. But in general, I try and take a step back and let other people treat family, because I'm too emotionally invested in the situation,
Okay, got a couple of texts here. Andy, will you ask the doctor if he knows any of the info on a pill that celiacs can have before dinner and still eat gluten? And let's see, someone had said there was one that was being developed. Our now 13-year-old has celiac and was diagnosed at age 10. Do you know, are they making advances that way?
You know, I don't know that they have officially put anything out. I think it is in development. I think there's hope for the future, but I don't know that it's there yet. That digesters and things like that will help with, for milk, you take lactase kind of things.
Yeah, lactate or dairy yeast or one of those.
And I think we'll get to that point. I just think it's more complicated with gluten, and I don't think that it's quite there yet. I could be a little, this isn't my area of expertise, I could be a little bit out of the loop, but I'm not aware of one. So.
Another text to ask the doctor about a product called Bleed Stop. Do you know what that is? Have you heard of that?
Yeah, there's a...
I'm gonna Google it while you're talking.
So there's new things coming out all the time. I think this cauterizes vessels so they don't bleed. We used to use similar things on bloody noses and stuff like that.
Yeah, so. In fact, it specifically mentioned when I did the search for bloody noses. Please stop for bloody noses. Yeah.
So I don't know that something like that will do well on like an open wound, a larger open wound. It's just, the kind of a bigger volume kind of thing. But
so is this a... like a powder, or is this a...
It can be. Most of the time we had it on like a cotton swab that we could swab onto things.
Okay.
Stuff like that. So...
Said, this is the BleedStop.com website. It says, clots, blood on contact, non-stinging, sterile, hypoallergenic, in addition to nosebleeds, great for shaving, nicks, and small cuts. So right there, it kind of implies right up front, this is not for big wounds.
If it's too big, it just doesn't have enough capacity to deal with it. But it's... I probably need some for my shaving nicks more often than
I think they called it a styptic pencil. Remember those? You cut yourself shaving and you put this little, get the pencil wet and put it on there, and it would create this little...
It's amazing. Trying to keep up just with the current science of things is always an interesting venture in our modern society, but it's good. Good. We live in a place where people are always trying to improve life and make it better.
As far as the Stop the Bleed class, if you want to register, go to swuhealth.com. Is that .com or
.org?
My bad. Swuhealth.org.
All of the governmental entities have to transition to .gov here soon. So
oh, really?
By the end of the year will be .gov.
Okay. Yeah. And the class is May 23rd. I think the one in St. George is 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon. So, and the one in Cedar City is at 10 o'clock in the morning. So, But arm yourself with knowledge so that when something happens, you are ready. This is a selfish one, but I woke up the other morning with a little, what I felt like was bursitis, a little pain in my shoulder joint. And it got me to thinking about joints as we age. And, you know, we hear about the tendonitis and bursitis. And, of course, those lead to bigger problems. Well, they can lead to bigger problems like needing joint replacement and stuff like that. How prevalent, you're in charge of this county that has a large senior population. Yeah. How big is this as far as a public health hazard, people needing those types of surgeries?
That's very common.
Very common.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is
there anything we can do to...
I think most of us will have something going on with one or two joints by the time we're done to just wear out over time, you know? And I think what the data shows is that consistent mild to moderate exercise really helps keep joints functioning properly over time, you know. So doing the things that cause the trauma to them, but doing the things that keep your muscles strong and everything in the right places and things like that. That's a great way to help your joints stay better longer.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear, because I think there is a feeling out there that some people say, yeah, if I run, my knees are going to get worse. Or if I play tennis, my elbows are going to get worse. That kind of assumption is out there. I use it more, it's going to get worse.
Yeah. So the key is mild to moderate, right? Not extreme.
Not
right?
Hardcore.
So the orthopedists will all say, when the Ironman comes into town, that's job security, because all those guys are going to need new knees, right?
Yeah.
And so we talked about that J-shaped curve. There's the optimum range, and then once you go beyond that, it's damaging, and that's kind of the spot we end up in. So yeah, you know, playing tennis two or three times a week with your friends is awesome. Playing tennis 8 hours a day, you know, is probably going to cause trouble all the time.
Well, and you say tennis, of course, the hot sport right now for the last decade or so anyway has been pickleball.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, Dr. Blodgett, I know people that play seniors that play every single morning. They play two to 3 hours every single day. Is that too much?
No, I think that fits in the kind of moderate category.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the ones that play 8 hours instead of two or 3 hours that you worry about a little bit.
Yeah, and pickleball isn't constant either. It's, you know, intermittent. So,
all right, let's go to the phone lines. Gary wants to talk about the Heimlich maneuver and other health-related deals. What's up, Gary?
Hi. I had a question. What would be the most important thing someone should learn? I'm an Eagle Scout. I've learned all this stuff. But I've used the Heimlich maneuver several times in my life, and I know others that have too.
Yeah.
My opinion is that might be number one.
Yeah, it might be. To feel powerless. I remember when our kids were born feeling really scared about that. So learning how to help kids when they're choking, you know,
yeah,
is something. And they do. They choke.
And, yes, they do.
And so, you know, I don't disagree. That could be in the top 10 for sure of things to know, because it's very common and something that is very definite that you can help with, right? It's not a powerless kind of situation. So
Heimlich maneuver is not passe. It's still a good tool to have to know how to help someone who's choking.
Yeah. So what did I hear? The people that were the descendants of Heimlich wanted money every time people use that name. So we should call it something else. But I'm not sure exactly how that works. But
not like the guy who invented the insulin, right? Where he wanted everybody to have it for free.
Yeah, exactly. No, a great suggestion. And, you know, Heimlich maneuver, there's just some basic things you can know in life that are just very helpful. Basic first aid, like we're talking about, Heimlich maneuver.
Pressure on the wound.
Just kind of the signs and symptoms of a heart attack and a stroke and some of those kinds of things, so you can get somebody to the doctor quickly. You know, those kind of basic skills are are really, really helpful.
Let's get a weather break in here, and then we'll talk about one of those other skills that you mentioned, the signs of a stroke. What are they, and what should we do if we see them? We'll be right back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Hey, we got good news during the commercial break. Dr. Blodge is going to tell us about the good news as he got a text during the break about the test.
Well, my staff corrected me. We've extended the free A1Cs until May 9th.
Nice. So you still have eight more days to get it done for free.
Come on in and get a free A1C test. We have a few left, quite a few actually, and so we're happy to offer that. So as a way to get an insight into where you're doing with diabetes, pre-diabetes, and that kind of stuff. So we're not offering this to people that already know they're diabetics and they just want to check their numbers. That's not what this is for. This is screening for people that haven't identified that they have either diabetes or pre-diabetes to see whether they have it. So there's a screening test that you take.
Right on the website, swuhealth.org. Right. And if you get, was it like a 5 or something or higher, then you need to, you should probably go
ask
and get
you questions
tested.
About age and, you know, weight, family history, that kind of stuff. And if you screen a certain number, we'll give you a free test and it'll give you a good indication where you're at on the scale. So
that's good. SWUhealth.org is the website. And, free test for another 8 days. So get her done. All right. A couple of things I noticed in the news they're talking about. They spent some time talking about how much does the health department, the government, I hate to lump you together, but you are technically, know about us. Now, you guys keep track of vaccinations, right? We have that. It's like a record. There's a file somewhere. If I went in there's a file that has my Andrew Griffin on it that's going to tell about whether I've been vaccinated. Do those records have anything else on them besides the vaccination records? Is there stuff that is there?
No.
No? Okay.
No. So our system in Utah is called USIS. So any provider that gives vaccinations puts those vaccinations in there. So it has basic information to so you can go back and get those records later. Name and address and phone number, date of birth. But it doesn't tie into a larger medical record or anything like that. So
my wife and I would be in there along with our 5 children. We would all have vaccination records. And now, does the health department remind people when they need shots? Like I have no idea when the last time I got a tetanus shot in is, or how often I even need a tetanus shot. Is that something the health department keeps an eye on and lets me know? Or
no, we have not developed that capacity for older people. We have some for when people come to us for their childhood immunizations, can send out notices for that. And IHC will do that too. But older folks, it's something to think about. We're always, there's never enough money, so you have to prioritize, but it's something to put on the list.
Yeah, something to think about. So, are there any of those vaccinations that we should be thinking about as we get older? Are you aware of any of them that were I ignored it for 40 years and maybe it's time to think about them again? Any that pop into your head?
Well, tetanus is a terrifying disease, so you want to do that every 10 years. Okay. I don't know if you've seen what the pictures look like for people who
have
tetanus.
I have not. No, I don't know that I dare do a search on that. It could be ugly.
It's unbelievable, So every muscle in your body tenses up.
Right.
And so they call it lockjaw because even your mouth muscles are clenched tight shut and you die a slow agonizing death without being able to, swallow or,
That sounds terrible.
So,
oh my gosh.
So, some of these diseases, when we talk about whether to get vaccinated or not, are terrible, terrible diseases. And tetanus itself is in the soil. It's kind of ubiquitous, right? And so it's not like some diseases where once we vaccinated for them, they disappeared. smallpox is the example of that. You know,
right,
used to,
right.
A third of people that got it used to die from it, and now it's no longer on the planet, but it's there. It's out there in so dirty, deep wounds. We think about that, and you know, you step on a nail, those kind of things. So, so that's every 10 years.
Okay. Well, I definitely haven't had a tetanus shot in the last 10 years. So.
We're to the point where pertussis circulates pretty freely in the population every year. So the saying is that if you have a cough that lasts longer than about 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, you probably have pertussis. About 60% of the time, that would be pertussis.
Okay.
And so getting a DPT or, you know, a tetanus with pertussis later on in life, it's not actually the current recommendation for that vaccine, but I more and more we're starting to see that as a way to to help protect. It's the babies that die from pertussis, right? 6 months and younger, but grandparents get it and then they take it to their babies. So pneumonia shot for older folks.
Okay. I didn't know. So there's a pneumonia vaccine.
Yeah. So, you know, the old man's friend pneumonia in combination with the influenza a lot is still the number one infectious disease killer in America. Overtook COVID very rapidly within a year after COVID came out. So you can get a pneumonia shot along with your ever faithful flu shot every year that we talk about. And the other shot that I would put on your adult immunization schedule is shingles.
I have not had that yet. I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the shingles shot can be a little bit challenging. You don't feel so good at the first couple of days.
Yeah, it's a robust immune response for sure, and your arm hurts. And but
everyone that I know that has had shingles said, "Yeah, I wish I'd had the vaccine because it's brutal."
And most of them say they get shingles and then they go get the shingles shots. They don't ever have to do it again. It's there's something about that. It's called post-herpetic neuralgia, where you actually have the disease bursting out of your nerves. That just is incredibly painful.
That sounds painful, yeah.
And sometimes it can get into your eyes, so you go blind. You know, I mean, it's just not a risk you need to do. So not a lot of deaths. This isn't an example where we're vaccinating for deaths, but it is an example where we're vaccinating for quality of life and trying to avoid something very nasty.
Now, shingles and chickenpox are related, correct?
Right. So you get chickenpox, the disease retreats into your nerves and hangs out there for the rest of your life.
Okay, so I had chickenpox when I was like, I don't know, 8 or something.
Right. And then something happens to decrease your immunity, that sees its moment, so it bursts forth. You know, a lot of times it's if, you know, you get some sort of chronic disease, cancer patients end up getting it quite frequently, you know, so... So I would put that on your list of things to get.
The shingles shot, do you have an age recommendation on that one?
Usually we say 65 or older. Okay. You can get it as young as 50 if you would like, but 65 and older is the general recommendation.
I had a friend, and I'm not trying to be pervert or anything, but she had it across her breasts. And couldn't wear a bra because it was so painful. Yeah. So she just didn't go out in public for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I guess shingles is really, really painful.
It is really painful. And
is there anything you can do for that pain if it does happen?
So you can take some antiviral medications, and they might help a little bit. But sometimes
I don't like the sound of might help a little bit. That doesn't sound good at all.
It's not a done deal.
There's nothing topically you could do.
You can try lotions. I mean, there's lots of things that people try, but in the end, I think it's just a lot of pain.
Oh. All right, don't get shingles. Do get the shingles shot is what we're saying. It seemed like there was one more I was going to ask about, but I'll get to it after we take this commercial break. Be right back with Dr. Blodgett.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Of course, we're going to talk about Iron Man for just a second because it is Iron Man week. That is Saturday morning. And, of course, we'll have all kinds of traffic situations. I know Stockton assures me he's going to have a post up on our website talking about all the traffic closures and things like that. Is it up yet? It is up right now. So you can go to our website, 890kdxu.com, and read about the traffic. But, of course, we have Dr. Blodgett here. We want to talk about the health effects of Iron Man. And you have long made no bones about it, Dr. Blodgett, that kind of athleticism, while admirable, is also not necessarily very good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's moderation in all things. And once you exceed the antioxidant capacity of your system, then you're doing more damage than good. But, you know, once you train to that degree, I think you've – it's just not most of us.
Right? Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know where to put the risk of it, you know, for an athlete that's trained, you know, 8 hours a day for 2 years, you know, to come and do something like this. So.
It's a weird thing because we all, you know, we have our jobs and we get good at our jobs. And, you know, for me, I'm a radio guy. I'm here 9-10 hours a day trying to get good at what I do. But for the most part, it doesn't affect my health.
Right.
But these guys, their body is their job.
Right.
So for 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day, they're training, toning, fixing, right. getting it better. And it seems like to me that after a while, my brother was a bicyclist for a long time, and he was going every day. He was 50, 60, 70 miles every single day. And he felt the effects of that in his crotch area.
Yeah.
After a while, those bicycle seats aren't very kind usually.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it just seems like after a while, that would really start to wear you down.
Well, you burn through, in an hour of intense exercise, you burn through all of the antioxidant, you know, capacity of the enzymes in your body. And then you end up in an antioxidant deficit, and that's when real damage can happen.
No, and we don't want real damage. No, that's bad. All right. A couple of things to clean things up here. You were talking about, what was it, diphtheria you were talking about? And what that does, if that were to make a comeback with people being kind of weird about vaccines?
I don't want to see a day when some of those vaccine-preventable diseases reemerge and circulate widely through the population. Diphtheria was a disease. It kills kids. Again, a lot of these are diseases that kill kids mostly, but diphtheria would kill people all through the lifespan, and it's it's an upper respiratory tract infection, but it causes a gray film exudate to coat the back of your throat and build up in the back of your throat.
So your throat slowly closes, basically.
Yeah, until it closes off and you die.
Wow.
10%. 20% of people that got it died. And so that's not anything to, you know, sneeze at. And,
no.
We're seeing it a lot. We're seeing measles. So measles is extremely easy to spread. And, you know, the rate at which you have to be vaccinated in a population called your herd immunity has to be really high because it spreads so easily. So 90% of the population needs to be vaccinated to stop it from spreading, and we're down below that.
Uh-oh.
Now in the rates of kids being vaccinated as they come up through. So we're going to start to see measles again. Mark Twain has a great story from his autobiography when he was when he decided to go into literary pursuits. He was 10 years old. He got measles. Everybody thought he was going to die. He said it was the most pleasant experience dying I've ever had.
Really?
And
wow.
The priest was there, and then he started to make he turned around. But from that time on, his mom stopped harassing him to do, I think she wanted him to be a lawyer or something. And he took up an apprenticeship at a printing shop, and it turned him into, you know, who he was. So
and now we have all this.
So, interesting how infectious diseases in history have played a really key role in a lot of things that have happened. The history of nations, you know, they're dictated by infectious diseases coming through, and the development of vaccines was and is one of the sentinel events that allowed modern society to emerge, because we weren't having a third to half of people die before they made 1 year of age, you know. So
you're a smart guy. Do you remember or do you recall reading about when vaccines really? It seemed for the first guy. I always joke about it. Well, who was the first guy to eat a mushroom, or who was the first guy that opened a clam up and said, "Ooh, that green, that great gooey stuff in there. I'm going to eat that." You know, what about the first guy that said, "Hey, you know what? If we inject you with a little bit of whatever, we stick it in your arm, it might make the disease go away."
So
you know,
this is a great story.
Yeah,
there was a process called variolation where people would expose people to. There's two forms of smallpox, one that kills 1 in 18, they call it variola minor, and one that kills one-third, that's variola major, right? And so they'd give people the 1 in 18 so they wouldn't get the 1 in 3. So that's kind of like the very earliest, you know,
vaccine-ish.
But the first true vaccine was a guy named Jenner in the late 1700s, noticed that women that got cowpox, that were nursing maids for cows and got cowpox, didn't get smallpox when it came through and killed a bunch of people in their community.
Hmm.
So he said, well, that's interesting. So he said, how about I... So he gets the neighboring boy down the street and exposes him to cowpox, makes sure he has cowpox. And then after he recovers from cowpox, then he gets smallpox and injects him with the smallpox, and he didn't die. So, but I don't think that
did mom and dad know he was doing
this?
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't think you could get approval for that study today.
No.
But that introduced the concept that you can teach the body to be able to fight off a disease without having this race, right? You versus the disease. Who dies first, right?
Yeah.
You fight the disease off, or you die from it. And and it was. Really a key moment in history. And then, you know, you make it into the 1950s when polio vaccine finally was developed, and, you know, people lined up around the block because polio was so terrifying, and kids in iron lungs and all the stuff that was going on, and you know, it just disappeared. Polio only exists in two places on the planet right now, and there's efforts to try and eradicate that. So I don't know. You think about diseases that kill, you know, COVID killed 0.15% of the population, you know. Polio killed, you know, 2-4%.
Wow.
Diphtheria, 10-20%. You know, I mean, these were diseases that were very scary and caused a lot of havoc in the world. So
I wanted to ask you before we go about rabies. There was a famous Office episode about the run to cure rabies, and it's like, well, it's already been cured. Why are you raising money to cure rabies? But give me the process on rabies. You always hear about, you know, it could be a raccoon or a possum or whatever animal has rabies. Is it something that, I know it's pretty rare, but is this something that we should be aware of and be concerned about at all?
Yeah, so in southern Utah, for the moment at least, most of the time we see rabies in bats.
Bats.
It can be in any larger mammal, usually chipmunks and stuff. They die too fast if they get it to have it be a problem. But so there are different strains. There's a canine strain, mm-hmm. there's a raccoon strain, and there's a bat strain. We have the bat strain here. And so we send a lot of bats in. The general rule is if you see a bat and it's catchable, that's really a bad idea.
That's
right?
Not good. Yeah. He's probably sick.
And, you know, so you're signed up for a 4-shot series of vaccinations, $500 a shot or more, going to the ER. Plus you have to have immune globulin, which, you know, immediately, which is in the side of the wound, which, you know, they call it a peanut butter shot for a reason. It's very thick, and you shoot that into your finger or something. That's no fun, right? So, so rabies vaccine. Rabies is 100% fatal. If you show symptoms of rabies,
and it's untreated, you will die. Wow.
Not even if it's treated. But so you gotta, if you think there's an exposure, there's an animal that's questionable, we will, you know, get that vaccine to you you know, quickly. You have
so
to do it
at what point does it become fatal then? You say even if it's treated, it's fatal if it's not treated in time?
It's, yeah. So if symptoms develop, if you start to have the actual disease, so it takes a while for the disease to make its way, and that's when you can vaccinate for it. That's why we don't vaccinate everybody. We only vaccinate people that have been exposed.
All right. He's Dr. Blodgett. I'm Andy. Thanks, Doc. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.